It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Higher prices are straining independent restaurants that are part of the fabric of the communities we live in. And industry economists tell The Wall Street Journal that wages for waitstaff, for table bussers and line cooks, they're all growing more expensive and cutting into slim profit margins. We check in on how restaurants in Wisconsin are faring with Luke Zahm, the co-owner of Driftless Cafe in Viroqua and host of Wisconsin Foodie on PBS Wisconsin. And you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts on eating out. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Luke, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh my gosh, it's so good to hear your voice again, Kate. How are you?
I'm doing well. Well, I want to start out with the cost that we see in restaurants. Consumer Price Index said March restaurant prices rose by over 4% since last year. What effects are you seeing out there on restaurants?
Well, you know, the restaurant like financial equation is perilous at best. I think on a national average, most restaurants, if they're lucky enough to turn a profit, it's between 4 and 5% of the total sales that they end up taking home at the end of the year. So it's very difficult when we see inflation come through, you know, and we feel as restaurateurs, like we need to be advocates to pay our staff's living wages, to keep up with the cost of living. You know, those numbers get real dicey. And about the only recourse available to restaurateurs or people selling food to the public is raising the prices a little bit. Of course, there's an associated sticker shock with that. When we go out to eat, we have an expectation. Some of us, you know, live within a budget. So it becomes much, much harder to kind of game plan like how we spend that money. But as a whole, the restaurant industry is very, very resilient, as we showed during COVID. And we're trying to find ways and resources and you know, create experiences that are memorable for people coming in without hitting them in the wallet too hard.
Well, you know, food isn't like a discretionary thing. I mean, we need to eat to live. Do the menu price fluctuations at all affect customer habits? I mean, what impact do they really have on the frequency that they would go to a restaurant?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, and I think it comes down to the model and style of the restaurant. Quite frankly, you know, some of the dining habits of people, you know, maybe they get a little bit more selective about when they go out or what they go out for. You know, fast casual restaurants in the state of Wisconsin and across the nation have been extremely successful since the pandemic. People kind of got into that habit of going out and having a casual transaction that they maybe notice more now. In hindsight, like, wow, suddenly to take my family of four out to even, you know, do fast food is pushing $40 to $50. And I think that sometimes they cut back on the fine dining a little bit and use that for special occasions. You know, going to a restaurant, knowing that you're going to spend good money for good food, is definitely in the minds of some of the consumers who, you know, undoubtedly support Wisconsin's restaurants.
I want to look a little bit closer here at staffing. Bureau of Labor Statistics says the leisure and hospitality industry has yet to reach its pre-COVID employment peak in Wisconsin. So how well-staffed are restaurants that you hear about and for yourself as well?
So the cafe is a little bit of an anomaly in the fact that, you know, we live in Viroqua, Wisconsin, population 4,500. We have a lot of chefs that want to come to Viroqua because they believe in the good food ethos that we have here in Southwest Wisconsin. And so, you know, we've had to do a couple different pivots. We've worked with a couple of local community partners to offer housing to chefs coming in so they can, you know, have a place to land specifically in a small community and better understand like what they need as a human when they arrive in a small town and participate in, you know, the Driftless Cafe. for other restaurants, I know that, you know, cooks and dishwashers, servers, bartenders, management, all of that is in relatively tight supply. And a lot of that is due to like the, you know, the reaction when we were asked to pivot during COVID and figure out like, how do we keep people safe? How do we keep serving food? How do we keep generating payroll for our staff to keep them employed? You know, a lot of restaurateurs saw ways to, you know, increase their efficiency. And sometimes fine dining is like the entire experience is meant to foster that idea of hospitality, which can be kind of the death of efficiency. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we see a lot of restaurants going either in one direction, which is, you know, we are going to have the most streamlined, financially successful and healthy model that we can create. The other ones are, you know, the outliers who embrace the intentional inefficiency and really try and create memorable dining experiences for people coming through the door. Maybe not with as much regularity as they did pre-COVID, but at the same time, you know, really trying to maximize their value and their experience.
Talking with Luke Zahm, restaurant owner and the host of Wisconsin Foodie, you can join in questions and comments as we discuss the restaurant scene, perhaps in your community, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Luke, there are costs that I don't think about when I'm dining out, like when I reach for the sugar packet for my iced tea, or, you know, the cost of the product that's used to wipe down tables or to wash the floors. What might some of those overhead costs be that we just don't see in restaurants that are invisible?
Yeah. You know, the invisible costs. Every time that you finish a meal and you decide, you know, like, I can't finish this, there's too much food, I'll take a to-go box. You know, I know with the cafe, those are 47 cents a box for us. Mm-hmm. That's not a cost that we usually build into the front end of the food and the labor model. So there's little incremental costs all along the way. If it's pizza boxes, if we are serving a pie to go as opposed to a pie in house, you know, that's another dollar that like the restaurant takes on. All of that, because a lot of those are sourced through big box, and I say that ironically, not big box retailers, but you know, when we're talking about broadline retailers, most restaurateurs don't necessarily have control if you're ordering from Performance Food Group or from Sysco or whomever you're getting a lot of your broadline supplies from, your paper goods. And sometimes those fluctuate wildly depending on what's going on in the larger restaurant market. And it can be very, very difficult to put your finger on that actual price and understand how that actually affects your total profit at the end of the day. Most restaurateurs don't get into the business to, you know, really study and pinch the pennies all the way through the operation. But, you know, everything that you see in that restaurant has a cost assigned to it. And if restaurateurs are buying those products and ingredients for, you know, the customer experience, if it's your sugar packet for your tea, if it's real maple syrup on the menu for the pancakes, if it's, you know, locally sourced honey, all of those things kind of add up at the end of the experience. And it comes down to like the drive of the restaurateur to ensure that that customers really, really do have that ability to come into the space, relax, and take away one of our many Wisconsin food experiences.
Which makes me wonder, though, as all of these input costs vary and sometimes vary wildly, what is the talk out there about dynamic pricing and changing your menu prices just based on those input costs?
Yeah, you know, that's kind of where the sticker shock comes in with a lot of consumers. And if there's one thing that I can say as a restaurateur, you know, people expect, enjoy, and appreciate consistency. It's really easy in a restaurant situation to look at like the food, you know, when it comes out, we get a pizza, it's burnt, or, you know, things have changed the ingredients and they're not as high quality. So, you know, maybe you get a pizza that's a little less, I guess, incredible. And maybe you're coming back to this idea of like what you remember the restaurant experience like. You know, when we get into that dynamic pricing, automatically when diners sit down, they're confronted with a change. Humans, as we well know, sometimes fear change. and so automatically you start that hospitality experience off with the sticker shock or, you know, going through like, I don't understand dynamic pricing. Like, what is this market price? I think we've all been in a situation when we wanted to order that special item off the menu and we go through the rigmarole with the server, like what is the market pricing? How is that determined? You know, just to get an understanding if that's the entree that we truly want to purchase or if it's something that we can live without at that moment. My philosophy on that is, you know, we want to have customers come in, feel like they can have a little bit of an expectation what they're about to get into financially, emotionally, experientially at the Driftless Cafe, and then feel confident moving forward. And a lot of times, specifically in economies like ours, price ends up being a little bit of a deterrent. So we see people come in and maybe not be able to get the food that they wanted, but we try and make sure that they walk away with everything and more in the restaurant experience.
Chef Luke Zahm, co-owner of Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, host of Wisconsin Foodie and PBS Wisconsin, as we check in on the stability, the vitality of local restaurants. And you can bring your perspective. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stubborn inflationary pressures make it difficult for independent restaurants to turn a profit. The publication Restaurant Hospitality describes it as tough sledding, but independent restaurant operators are tough people, and many have found new ways to stay afloat and continue serving their communities. As we focus on the vitality of Wisconsin restaurants, call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Luke Zahm is here, co-owns the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, as host of Wisconsin Foodie on PBS Wisconsin. Okay, Luke, this is a bit of the fun part here. There's a new report estimates over 3/4 of consumers are excited about new food options at restaurants this year. What food trends are exciting you?
Well, you know, that's a tough question for me because I'm always excited by the idea and the ability to get more localized ingredients, specifically ones that come from the upper Midwest and Wisconsin. I mean, it's no secret that that's my MO. But some of the other food service trends that I see, like, you know, fast casual dining options. It doesn't have to be the case where, you know, restaurateurs go in and they have this grand concept to do 120 seats and pump out food on a volume that, you know, quite frankly, is a little bit unsustainable in this labor market. And so smaller restaurants, you know, independently owned restaurants that have fast casual ideals, that highlight more of like Wisconsin's ethnic diversity, I think are some of the things that I look for when I travel to smaller municipalities all over the state. I want to taste the flavors of Wisconsin that are a little bit outside the box, you know, and I think that the Wisconsin right now and the nation in general is really kind of looking towards those trends. So if it's global flavors with local ingredients, well, local farm stories, you know, those things are always so, so exciting for me. But I see a lot of smaller restaurants popping up, if it's Madison, Milwaukee, Superior, where it's people putting out their values, putting out their ideas for food and finding ways to accomplish that with less dining seats. And oftentimes that is like the fast casual market, which is great.
Well, I'm going to push you on outside the box because trillions of cicadas are about to emerge. Are you considering, you know, sautéing, frying up any cicada apps.
Are you asking me if I'll cook insects in the cafe?
Yes, well,
sure. You know, I've done this before where, you know, chapulines using crickets, you know, that will sometimes bring in from Mexico, doing special dinners that, you know, really highlight that as a protein source. Sure. You know, I think that there's a way to actually get diners through that experience into something that is delicious and memorable and kind of fun. You know, most of us have that childhood association with, like, did you eat worms? Did you not eat worms? You know, all those things are kind of fun. You know, whether or not the dining public leans into that, that is going to be a little bit of a difficult sell. You know, I think I will say that more than likely we won't be serving cicadas, Kate. I just want to put that out there for everybody.
That's okay, but, Luke. That's okay.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I may mess with them a little bit on my own term, but, you know, to ask people to come in and do a quesadilla with cicadas in it, albeit they would be local, you know, may not be the jam. Well, if I can get local cicadas, I'll consider it. How about that?
Okay, we'll leave it at that. But, you know, here's something we are leaning into, and that is the reality TV show Top Chef. And I want to get your hot take on the show. What are you thinking?
Well, the Top Chef effect is real, you know. And Top Chef is one of the longest running and most successful reality cooking shows on television. And what people see from that is locations where Top Chef is filmed. You know, people from all over the United States and the world come into those places in order to have their own experience. I think it's great for Wisconsin. You know, a good friend of mine has been quoted often saying, like, Wisconsin is having her moment.
Oh.
And as a kid who grew up in Lafarge, Wisconsin, population 745, you know, I've been fighting my whole career to get people to dispel the notion that, like, Wisconsin and the upper Midwest is culinary flyover country. When a production like Top Chef decides that they are going to land in the state of Wisconsin and highlight some of our specialty foods, our cheeses, our farmers, you know, our interesting citizens, that actually is a very, very real growth in awareness. And, you know, you're going to see a lot of people come to Wisconsin in order to have, you know, a similar experience for themselves, which is great. It's great. We're having our moment. we're no longer culinary flyover country. You know, they hate us because they ain't us when it comes to our cheeses.
And this is how we do a farmer's market. Like, I mean, come on, let's set an example here.
Exactly. And, you know, going back to all that, you know, when you were talking about dynamic pricing and things like that, one of the things that the cafe we really, really noticed and paid attention to during COVID is when we were buying food and when we are buying food from our local farmers, food producers, artisans, those prices don't actually fluctuate that much. It's based on a system that's more controlled. There's less shipping costs. There's less delay in that. So, you know, those sourcing agents are much more stable for us. And quite frankly, they evangelize our food identity. And I think that that is such a wonderful thing to have experienced and understood. So now when people from across the globe come to Wisconsin to have their culinary experience, hopefully those local farmers and food producers end up on the winning side of that financial equation.
In our last moments together, you know, here we are in that spring season. We're just kind of waiting for those fresh veggies that we know are going to start coming in the summer, early summer. You know, what foods are a must try for restaurant goers, the really fresh stuff? What should we look for?
Okay. You know, I actually went out during the eclipse and went canoeing on the Kickapoo River. And I got into one of my favorite ramp patches. You know, they are about probably a week away, week and a half away from finding their ways onto restaurant menus. And I got to say, like, being able to dig something out of the forest soil and, you know, appreciate it, like the first taste of spring. We're so close. I am so tired of making pickles and root vegetables at the cafe and like trying to reimagine the way to cook the same seven vegetables that we've been working with for 4 months. Look for the vitality in the menus. Look for things that the chefs are excited about. When the servers are coming to you telling you about what's new on the menu, you know, take a risk, try that. See what they're doing with those local foods and local flavors. I guarantee you, it's a blueprint for us as a restaurant community to be able to really express our love and care and excitement about a lot of those ingredients that are coming to us from our forests, our farmers, and our food producers.
Oh, Luke, so good to talk to you. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me. I really appreciate you.
Chef Luke Zahm co-owns Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, hosts Wisconsin Foodie for PBS Wisconsin. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Trillions of cicadas are due to emerge in more than a dozen states, including in southern Wisconsin. Science outlets like BBC Wildlife call it Cicadageddon. We get a preview of periodical cicadas and what to expect, and you can call in with a question. Share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mike Hillstrom is a forest entomologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and part of the DNR's Forest Health Team. Mike, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, set us up with this preview about this emergence, the cycle, how many more cicadas than usual will come to the surface in southern Wisconsin?
Yeah, so exciting times for entomology fans in Wisconsin. For the first time in 17 years, we will get an emergence of cicadas in southern Wisconsin, and that'll go through Iowa, Illinois. Cool thing this time around is for the first time in 221 years, the brood to the south that kind of starts in central Illinois will actually, and then go south and all the way to the East Coast will come out as well. So that's where you get into trillions of cicadas across, you know, many states across the eastern U.S. So it's going to be exciting to see it. In Wisconsin, we're going to have the 17-year cicadas. The ones to the south are 13-year cicadas. So that refers to their, you know, to their life cycle. So they're underground feeding as nymphs for 13 or 17 years. They emerge, you know, as adults, mate, lay eggs, and then the cycle goes on. So
why do broods vary in length? 13 years, 17 years. There's a 12-year cycle, I think. Why the variations?
Yeah, so, you know, that's still kind of up for debate in a lot of ways as to exactly how those distinct timelines, you know, sort of evolved. But the main kind of purpose overall of having that long of a life cycle is, you know, predator avoidance, really. So if you emerge in the trillions, there's really no chance that, you know, any sort of predator is going to be able to, you know, to eat that many insects. So it's a great predator avoidance strategy.
Why is northern Wisconsin less affected?
Yeah, so, you know, it probably has to do mostly with climate. So the 17-year broods are, you know, the farther north broods, whereas the 13-year broods tend to be farther south. So it probably, like, you know, most things with insects, just has to do with temperature. So in Wisconsin, well, for cicadas in general, you know, they come out, these periodical cicadas emerge when the soil temperature at about 8 inches deep gets to about 64, 65 degrees. So, you know, southern Wisconsin hits that threshold at, you know, kind of the right time for these cicadas to emerge.
Oh, okay. So there is something that really happens in the environment. So cicadas know when it's time, when the time is right to emerge, and that rhythm, you said, really has to do with soil temperature?
Yes, exactly. So it has to do with that. That soil temperature seems to be their primary cue for when they know to come out. How exactly they know, It's been 13 years or 17 years since, the last one emerged is sort of still up for debate, I guess.
You're not
That's
getting much out of your cicada interviews these days. I don't know.
no, it's a little tricky to get them to, I mean, they're very loud, they're very talkative, right? But they don't seem to want to answer our questions directly.
Especially
So
those males. What is up with the buzz? How do they make that sound?
yeah, so they have this really cool structure called a timbal organ, and it's basically and actually their bodies are kind of hollow at the back as well. So it's like this resonating chamber. So they can make this loud sound. And any individual cicada is not necessarily that loud. But when you get, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, millions of these things all in the same area, and they all start producing that sound at the same time, that's where you get this really intense, sound. If you stand under a big tree that has, thousands of cicadas in it, you're probably going to want some hearing protection. It's going to be real loud.
I wondered, how do the females respond?
Yeah, so the females don't have the same kind of sound organs, but they can flick their wings in a way that makes a kind of a response noise that so that the males know where they are.
That's so interesting. Remind us where cicadas live and what makes a good cicada habitat?
Sure. So yeah, so cicadas need kind of deciduous forest, and there's some numbers out there. They actually need a pretty good chunk of forest. So if you look at the map of where cicadas are in Wisconsin, it's kind of across the southern two or three tiers of counties in the state, but you don't really see any over in like the Milwaukee area that's more developed. So they need a good chunk of deciduous forest, and that's because during that 13 and that 17 or 17 years, the 17 years in Wisconsin, those nymphs are underground feeding on root tissue. So they need, you need a lot of space, obviously, for millions and millions of cicadas to feed on root tissue. Now, the cool thing is, this is not something that's damaging the trees. So, even though they're feeding on that root tissue, it's not something that's harming the trees. So this is really just a cool event that we all get to experience.
We're talking about cicada mania with DNR entomologist Mike Hillstrom, fielding your questions. You can join in questions and comments about the cicada emergence. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, a large number of the people traveled from Wisconsin to other states to get better views of the eclipse on Monday. Do you expect people will do a similar thing, trek to central Illinois, where the double brood emergence in the trillions is expected?
Yeah, so I definitely think there'll be a fair number of people that are going to be interested in this. I mean, this is going to be a super rare event. Again, these two broods only come out at the same time every 221 years. So, even rarer than an eclipse on that note. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. They really don't actually overlap in the same forest much. So if you were to take a trip from, let's say, like Chicago and start going south through Illinois, you'd actually just keep kind of hitting different species. And so the other interesting part of this whole cicada thing is that there's actually three species of the 17-year cicadas and four species of the 13-year cicadas that all join in these different broods. So it's this really complicated kind of interesting where you have multiple species, even on different, kind of time cycles, all emerging synchronized. So, fascinating from a scientific perspective.
And that's exactly when I checked out. I said, okay, leave it to the entomologist on that one. I was like, who, what, where?
Yeah.
So with you in the forest, will you be adding more fields time into your schedule, or how will you mark this time?
Yeah, so my job in the summer is being out in the woods and helping landowners out or helping foresters out, diagnose tree health issues. So as far as that goes, we don't expect this to be a major health issue for trees. What I will say though is we do have a spongy moth outbreak potentially going on at almost the exact same time. So it's possible that you could get places where You have caterpillars defoliating trees. You have cicadas buzzing around doing things. So it could be a really interesting year from an insect perspective of just what's going on out on the landscape. So I will definitely be out there checking out what's going on, and kind of keeping track. And you know, anybody who wants to join in the fun, UW just put up a new website about cicadas yesterday. You can read up there. But there's also a new tracking form to help us kind of get a better idea exactly where all these emergences are occurring. So if anybody's interested, you know, that's a new way you can kind of help us track where these cicadas exactly are in the landscape.
Oh, so there is a citizen science component here to all this cicada action.
Exactly. So, yep, brand new, hot off the press as of last night. Cicadas.wisc.edu. If anybody wants to check that out, I definitely encourage that. And yeah, that's where you can find the citizen science component as well.
And so, how long will the cicadas stay? What is their duration usually?
Yeah, so any individual cicada will only live a couple of weeks, 2, 3 weeks, but they come out over a period of about 2 or 3 weeks. So we'll have them around for roughly 4 to 6 weeks. It'll probably start based on historical records, maybe the last week of May, and go, you know, there'll be a few hanging on maybe towards the end of June yet. So late May, early June are going to be the prime time to get out and see the cicadas.
But you know, I feel like in the dog days of summer, I hear cicadas. Is that because of a different emergence, or is it because maybe I'm, you know, of where my location is? I just feel like I've heard them later on in the summer months.
Yeah, exactly. You got that right. So there are what we actually call annual cicadas or dog day cicadas that are out every year. So they actually have a multi-year life cycle as well, but some of those are out every year. And so those cicadas you hear in, you know, August and September, those are a different set of species of cicadas. So if anybody's curious the difference, those annual cicadas, they're pretty big. They have green wings. These periodical cicadas that come out earlier are actually smaller. They have kind of orangey red wings, and they have these bright red eyes. So pretty distinguishable as far as, you know, the individual species. It really actually comes down to the calls they make to be able to distinguish them. They look so similar in most cases. But yeah, we have these kind of two different types of cicadas. So Wisconsin, all over Wisconsin, we see those, you know, annual cicadas every year.
I suppose I won't put you on the spot to make those calls.
Yeah, I have not practiced that one. That would be a good trick to learn though. So maybe this summer, as you know, I'm out in the woods and I hear them, I'll work on that and we can do a revisit of that.
Hillstrom, a forest entomologist with the state DNR, our guide to the emergence of these cicada broods, 13, 17. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's a double brood year for cicadas. That is rare, as we've been talking about. Parts of southern Wisconsin and the northern half of Illinois will be in prime spots to hear the songs of periodical cicadas. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your insights at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Mike Hillstrom with us, forest entomologist with the DNR's Forest Health Team. Let's bring in Duke in Viroqua. Duke, hi. What would you like to ask?
Yes. Good morning. I'm a trout fisherman in southwestern Wisconsin, and I have fished in New Zealand, where at certain times of the year, cicadas are a major food source for the trout population, and they're widely used as a fly to imitate them. Should I be tying flies to imitate this emergence in southwest Wisconsin? And if so, how big?
Duke, thank you. Mike.
I will say any wildlife, basically, if they can get their hands on a nice tasty cicada is going to do it. It's a pretty tasty snack. So absolutely, I think that would be a great thing to try out. The cicadas are, these periodical cicadas are probably roughly, about an inch. So I started that size. I do think to some degree the vibration, that kind of sound that they're making with the wings is also really attractive. When you get this, kind of vibrating thing on the ground, I think that's really attractive to, birds and probably if they get near the water, fish as well. So, I can't say I'm an experienced fly fisherman, but I would say absolutely give it a shot. I think the trout would love it.
Duke, how does that sound? Go for it.
That sounds great. Then I'll tie them at a number 6 to a number 8. I don't exactly know how to do red eyes yet. And when I put them on the water as a dry, then I'll probably twitch them a little bit. And we'll see what happens.
Sounds great. Report back. Let us know how it goes.
Yeah, experiment in action. Duke, thank you so much. Well, let's talk a bit about eating cicadas. Some people eat them. If you want to make a meal of cicadas, the Food Network advises cooking them like seafood. There have been recipes floating around for cicada soups and salads. Cupcakes are in the mix, cocktails. So do you have any recommendations for eating cicadas?
So, this is one of those personal things. I equate it to, eating mushrooms. There's always a risk in eating something that's, out on the landscape. So I've seen some reports in some places because they're underground for, 13 or 17 years, they can accumulate some mercury or something like that. So I guess as with all things, take precautions, but there's certainly lots of recipes out there and, anything in moderation is probably okay. But again, that's really an individual decision. I've eaten crickets and grasshoppers and mealworms over the years. So, I like to tell people, insects are basically no different than eating a shrimp or a lobster. It's really the exact same thing, but somehow we find one a delicacy and the other one scary. So get out there and experiment. Absolutely.
Can you easily distinguish cicadas from other insects?
Yeah, cicadas are pretty obvious. They're pretty good size. There's not a lot of other things that look like a cicada. So, again, get on a website, check out a few things, but they're definitely one of the easier insects to identify.
And you mentioned earlier that cicadas pose no harm. Trees are fine. So should pesticides be used against cicadas at all?
Yeah, so really, there's almost no situation where we would ever recommend using, insecticides on cicadas. The off chance, there's a wine grower and the grapevines are getting attacked, maybe in that situation, but really physical exclusion does the trick. They're so big that it's easy just to physically exclude them with some bird screening or something to that effect. We don't recommend using any insecticides at all. Just if you do have the only situation where like a yard tree that's maybe 3, 4, 5 years old, where the branches are kind of just the right size for the cicadas to lay their eggs, those are the situations where you might want to protect that tree a little bit, just because it's young and it doesn't have a ton of branches. So if a lot of cicadas were to lay eggs in that same tree, you could get some significant branch damage. But again, just physical exclusion is really the easiest way to deal with it.
Talking with DNR entomologist Mike Hillstrom. Call in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mike, with these cicada maps kind of popping up around all over the place, how accurate is this tracking and mapping?
Yeah, so this is one of those interesting, I was chatting with a coworker yesterday, and the last time these came out in Wisconsin, and she had some maps of photocopied plat books with, highlighter on them. So let's just say we've come a long way in 17 years on the technology front. You know, we have apps out there now that can track all this stuff. So while the historical records are, you know, probably mostly pretty good, these populations do change over time. So one of the kind of famous studied spots down in Illinois, where they estimated over 1 million cicadas per acre, there's actually no cicadas at that site anymore. Just land development and some other issues. So, you know, while these cicadas do tend to pop up in the same places over time, there's certainly changes across the landscape as well. So I think it's going to be really cool with, you know, kind of the new technology in everybody's hands. Everybody has a smartphone where they can help us track, you know, these populations now. So I suspect we'll be getting quite a bit of new data this time around.
Let's go to Amy in Madison. Amy, hello.
Hi there.
Hi, we can hear you. Yeah.
Great. I had a question. My daughter is getting married on June 15th in Elkhart Lake at 4 p.m. It's an outdoor wedding, and we're wondering if we have to be worried in any way about the cicadas.
Should they worry, Mike, about the sound of those cicadas at an outdoor wedding in Elkhart Lake mid-June?
So there are definitely some cicada populations down that way. So Lake Geneva is sort of the known hot spot, one of the known hot spots. So it's definitely possible you could have some cicadas, but from a, you know, from a risk perspective, they don't bite, they don't sting. You know, even if they flew into you, they're very kind of, I equate it to like a chunk of popcorn. They're just kind of light. They're not going to hurt in any way. So, yeah, the sound could be in the background, but I would say you can go out there and find people that are actually planning their weddings around having them in places with cicadas. So that's kind of a novelty thing. So, yeah, I don't think you have anything to worry about. You know, it could get a little loud if you're right under a big group of trees. You might have to make a slight adjustment in that case. But beyond that, just enjoy the spectacle.
Okay, we only have seconds left here. Spongy Maths, just a quick hit here. This spring, what are you anticipating as they start to hatch and feed on trees and shrubs?
Yeah, so we set a record last year with over 370,000 acres of defoliation across the state. So the best thing I can say is let's hope we keep this rain coming. Fungus and a virus that kill the caterpillars, which get promoted by kind of rains in April and May. So keep the regular rain coming, and hopefully that helps resolve the issue for us.
Anything homeowners can do as they see them?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of different management methods. It really depends if you're talking about individual trees or, you know, all the way up to forests. Kind of similar to cicadas, I say I'd recommend going to spongymoth.wi.gov.
Okay.
We just revamped the entire website, and it's got every detail you could ever want to know about managing spongy moth. So great resource for everybody to take a check out.
Mike, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Mike Hillstrom is a forest entomologist with the DNR's Forest Health Team. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Rural Partnerships Institute at UW-Madison funds a new project focused on helping rural communities prepare for extreme weather and natural disasters. And a separate grant focuses on groundwater quality in the Central Sands region. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org along the way. Jed Cahoon is a professor of plant and agroecosystem sciences at UW-Madison. Jed, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And Ken Jensko is here, professor of planning and landscape architecture at UW-Madison. Ken, welcome.
Good morning. My pleasure.
Ken, let's start with you. The Agriculture Department funding two new projects by the Wisconsin Rural Partnerships Institute. Can you explain what is the goal of the institute?
Well, the institute broadly is focused on rural health, rural vitality. I believe the mission is to conduct research and outreach focused on the social and economic vitality of rural communities across Wisconsin. And it's a relatively recent institute coordinated by UW-Madison College of Ag and Life Sciences and the Division of Extension.
Jed, there's that big and bold stat on the front of the institute site. It says 64,793 farms in Wisconsin. Why should we pay attention to that number?
These rural farms provide a basis for our economy across Wisconsin and a great deal of economic input that is multiplied across the landscape to help us maintain roads, provide schools, and in general support the rural economy and the people that reside across the state of Wisconsin.
Do you find in your work that there is enough research focus and, grants specific for the rural parts of our state?
Yeah, I think there are significant opportunities. The real benefit here is that it ties together a lot of great ideas from among the research communities here at UW-Madison and other UW system institutions. The Division of Extension here at UW-Madison, and our rural partners. And that's the real significant opportunity here is to become embedded in these rural communities with our research ideas, really exemplifying and carrying out the Wisconsin idea as we have for 175 years now.
Ken, your project looks at a different aspect of rural life and how to protect small communities from extreme weather brought on by climate change. This is something that communities all over are grappling with. Who will you be working with? What will your focus be here?
Well, you really pointed it out. We're recognizing, this project is recognizing that there have been increased occurrences of extreme weather events across the country, across the Midwest, and those have affected Wisconsin. And just tapping into a couple of recent facts, the Wisconsin's warmest winter on record just ended. It had the highest winter temperature. I think we had 77 degrees somewhere, and the first February tornadoes that were reported. And yet also within the past decade, we've had two extreme cold waves, both in 2014 and 2019, and people are currently dealing with false springs, this concern about weather affecting plants and confusing how plants and especially fruit trees and others are beginning to grow. So we're focusing on three different parts of the state, communities in three different parts of the state, and rural residents in the Driftless area, the Central Sands, and in the north. And we're still working to define which communities we'll be engaging with, really building on existing relationships and those who are interested in our project and are looking for the kind of support that we're going to be offering.
How do you envision this project, helping communities deal with climate change? What is the application like here?
Well, we're especially interested in development with communities and rural residents and applications of new tools. And by that, I mean really digital tools that allow for applications of data, improving decision support processes, helping people think through what are some things that they're information that they're needing for their operations and ways to visualize how that might make a change. And we're looking at different scales. If you think about rural life, information is needed at different time scales, from sometimes real-time data about soil moisture conditions, for example, or rainfall, or longer days, months, and even longer periods for other kinds of planning decisions. So our hope is to find new sources of data with people and help organize and interpret that data in a way that's useful for their decision-making.
We're talking about new projects funded underway through the Wisconsin Rural Partnerships Institute. That is Ken Jesko. We also have UW-Madison Professor Jed Cahoon. You can join in questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jed, your project is geared toward helping protect drinking water in the Central Sands region of the state. What will you be looking at?
Our project really has two areas of emphasis. Number one is to look at agronomically reasonable, feasible, and economical solutions that can be adopted by farmers in the Central Sands region, specifically to address nitrates and groundwater. As it stands now, there's general acknowledgement of the issues related to groundwater quality in the Central Sands, but we don't have a lot of practical solutions that could be adopted behind the farm gate. So the first aspect of the project is to look at solutions that farmers can adopt to improve groundwater quality. Now, that research is only as good as the adoption, of course, to achieve that improved groundwater quality outcome. So the second piece of the project is to embed ourselves within those communities in the spirit of the rural partnership in very diverse audiences and ways and interests, ranging from those interested in the environment around agriculture, wetlands, lakes, rivers, those concerned with the human health aspects as it relates to nitrates and groundwater, as well as all the farmers and farmer-led watershed groups that are trying in earnest to find practical solutions. So we'll do the research, but we'll also embed ourselves from day one to make this a WE project, not only to make sure that we're grounded within the region and within local communities, but to make sure that our work represents the diverse interests across the rural Central Sands region.
And Jed, can you pause there and take us closer to the land? Describe the Central Sands region, where it is, what is grown there, what it's like?
Sure. This is a very unique region geologically and hydrologically. It's a 2 million acre portion of the central part of the state of Wisconsin, as captured in the name. And this was the former Glacial Lake, Wisconsin. So if you could picture basically a bathtub filled with water, but also with sand in areas up to 275 feet deep of deep, coarse sands. These sands are great from an agricultural perspective, particularly for the specialty crops in the region, such as potatoes and processing vegetables, because the soils drain quickly. So largely, we can manage water as an input via irrigation with reduced risk of rotting out crops in heavy soils that maintain soil moisture. Conversely, the challenge here is that the soils drain quickly. And when they do, we call that leachate to groundwater. And in that leachate water, in high-risk situations that aren't managed carefully, the leachate can also contain some of our agricultural inputs. Our focus in this case is on nitrogen used as fertilizer and the implications of nitrates in our groundwater in that region. So it's a real balance to find ways to maintain that rural benefit of $5.8 billion from specialty crops in the region, 25,000 jobs across the rural landscape, but doing that in a way that we can also have high quality groundwater for human consumption.
That is a balance. Jed Cahoon there and Ken Jensko there, UW-Madison professors, extension specialists, and project leaders on two new grants from the Wisconsin Rural Partnerships Institute that's aimed at reducing water pollution, preparing for climate change as well. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your perspective at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Rural Partnerships Institute at UW-Madison, it aims to find solutions to challenges facing rural parts of the state. And we explore two new grant projects. One focuses on how to respond to natural disasters. The other aims to protect water quality in the Central Sands region. Call in along the way. You can ask a question, share your thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. UW-Madison professors and extension specialists Jed Cahoon and Ken Jensko are project leaders. Ken, connect the dots here. What overlap could there be in doing, a project on climate change preparation and what Jed is doing in the area to protect groundwater in the Central Sands? Are there any overlaps here?
Yeah, Kate, there really are a lot of connections between what Jed described and what our approach, what we're taking with our approach, and really with the other projects funded through the Rural Partnerships Institute as well. And I'd like to focus on what Jed said about making this a we project. I think the idea of being inclusive and involving the people we're working with across the state is really going to be central to all of our projects. We're really focusing on three sets of stakeholders or rural actors with our projects. Farmers and their farm ag advisors as one group. So really right there, a natural overlap with what Jed was just talking about. We're also going to be working with the professionals that are already involved in hazard management and disaster preparedness, professionals focused on environmental management, the hazard planners, and public health officials in rural Wisconsin as part of our second group. And then we're also going to be focusing on rural school districts. And of course, all of these groups together influence the vitality of rural life. Many of the solutions and approaches that people are taking to prepare for climate change and for the preparing for extreme weather events involve nature-based solutions and looking at the landscape and how can soil absorb more water, for example, how can natural cover be added to places to improve the overall natural function of the environmental systems. So in that sense, there's a lot of overlap with what Jed has been talking about.
What comes to mind for me here is that when disaster strikes, there's a plan. There's a plan. It's on paper somewhere. Maybe it's in a binder on a shelf. How do you ensure what you want to implement here doesn't just age on a shelf and is actively used?
Thanks for asking that question. I think that's one of the big concerns about planning and preparation. And really, they're two big values out of planning. One is the process of going through developing a plan and thinking through what are all the issues that we could be confronted with, who needs to be involved in this conversation, are the right people aware of what they might need to do at any particular time. And that's whether it's an incident like an immediate disaster or a longer term change that's being developed. So our approach is going to be really for the first year of this project, listening and engaging with actors who are responsible for those kinds of things in rural area. They already have many tools that they use and some tools that are out there that aren't being used. And part of our inquiry will be for the tools that do exist. In fact, some of our team members have created different kinds of indices and spatial visual kinds of tools that are accessible to communities. But if they're not using them, why not? And what could we do to make them better? And what additional needs might they have that aren't being addressed with current approaches?
Jed, you said you want to embed in the region that being underway. How concerned are residents in the Central Sands about their water?
I think generally there's a broad concern from several aspects. Number one, the number of private wells that have nitrates in them that exceed the Environmental Protection Agency's drinking water standard is high and has been increasing over recent years. So that requires treatment in private residential wells that can be quite expensive, about a $1,500 initial investment for the treatment systems, and annual maintenance that can range from $100 to $300 per household. So there's the financial cost, but also the health risk related to nitrates and groundwater and private residential wells. There are also environmental implications, given that this groundwater also forms some of the lakes, rivers, and streams where it's exposed in the region. So there's concern about the contaminants in that ecological and recreational habitat in the region also. I think there's pretty broad and general acknowledgement of the issues. Our focus here is really to provide reasonable solutions so that agriculture and clean drinking and recreational ecological water can coexist.
You mentioned the private wells, and one major development on the waterfront this week, the Environmental Protection Agency announcing new federal standards for toxic forever chemicals, PFAS. What are the threats to drinking water with PFAS and in the Central Sands area?
Yeah, and that isn't a specific focus of this project, although the work that we're doing to improve groundwater quality will address many aspects. Our focus right now is on nitrates as the long-term issue that we're focused on addressing at this point. But the practices that we adopt, such as continuous living cover crops, efforts to reduce leachate in general to groundwater, will also address some of those other aspects, such as the forever chemicals, in reasonable ways.
We're talking about new projects funded through the Wisconsin Rural Partnerships Institute with UW-Madison professors Jed Cahoon there and Ken Jensko is here. Call in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Ken, as you mentioned from the outset, this is a relatively new institute. What other projects would you like to see emerge from the Wisconsin Rural Partnerships Institute? What is the future like?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think listeners who are interested in learning more can Google the Rural Partnership Institute, if that would help them. It's ruralpartners.wisc.edu, and that describes the variety of projects that are there right now. Issues focused on, for example, community mental health. There's a project that has been funded for that. Another one looking at indigenous food systems. So the whole host of issues that are affecting rural Wisconsin. One of the issues that we're addressing with this project is, first, I guess, recognizing that, well, there's a wealth of partnerships already active in rural areas, and a lot of them focused on environmental issues, of course, on public health issues and the overlaps there. In fact, many of those working on water issues are gathered this week in Stevens Point. It's Water Week, and the annual Lakes and Waters, Lakes and Rivers Convention is being held there right now. So people who are invested in groundwater concerns, lake management, and of course rivers are all gathering and talking about those issues. And with this project, we're, as Jed said with his, looking to work with those people who are already active in the area and trying to add additional resources where the capacity might be stretched kind of thin in some of our rural communities.
Jed, as you look at those connections, this institute is part of a larger USDA initiative. You've got University of Vermont in the mix and Auburn. How does UW-Madison fit into the larger picture here of what's being funded and worked on?
I think this provides a model for a lot of the land-grant institutions to be able to work more effectively with rural partners. I feel in Wisconsin we've done that very well with our division of extension spread across the state with good coverage. But this really puts an emphasis on the partnership component of that, not only doing good research at our UW system institutions, but really getting involved and in-depth on the challenges and issues, as well as the opportunities that we have across rural Wisconsin in very effective and meaningful ways. So this really puts a point on work that we've been doing for a long time now, of course, but in very specific ways to benefit the state of Wisconsin and beyond. And then that model could be adopted by other states as a very modernized way of doing outreach to reach citizens that may not be in our more urban areas.
Jed and Ken, thank you so much for joining us and for describing this research.
Thank you very much for having us.
Jed Cahoon is a professor of plant and agroecosystem sciences at UW-Madison. Ken Jensko is a professor of planning and landscape architecture at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Soil fumigants are pesticides applied to soil to control weeds and pests in the soil. The state agriculture department says in some cases, Wisconsin law is stricter about their use than federal environmental regulations. We learn about the latest Wisconsin research on soil fumigants, and you can call in to ask a question. You can add your comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Richard Lankow is an associate professor of plant pathology, leads a lab focused on plant microbes and soil health in the UW-Madison College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Richard, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So your team collected soil and potatoes from 7 commercial potato fields in Wisconsin, located in the central and northern regions of the state. How do potato farming practices differ in these two areas?
They're different in a number of ways, most importantly because they're grown for different purposes. So most of the potatoes that we eat are grown in the central part of the state, in that central sands region. And in the northern part of the state, we're growing potatoes largely to serve as what we call seed potatoes for other potato growers. So they're managed for different purposes, and they deal with very different soils and very different problems.
And you focused on these types of fields. Why potatoes?
Why potatoes? Well, partly because they're a really important crop globally, and they're a really important crop for Wisconsin. We're one of the nation's largest producers of potatoes. But they're also a really challenging crop to grow. Because they're grown underground, they have to deal with a lot of soil-borne issues, including really consequential diseases caused by fungi, nematodes, and bacteria that require some intense management.
Can you walk us through how soil fumigation works, what that process is like?
Yeah. So as you said earlier, it's a process where a liquid is injected into the soil, beneath the surface of the soil. And then that liquid volatilizes, means it kind of evaporates into a gaseous form. And then that gas percolates up through the soil profile. And the chemical is toxic to a wide range of organisms, including pathogens, but also all sorts of microbes, bacteria and fungi and nematodes, which are the tiny little worms.
And so this process has also been called sterilizing the soil. Is that a way to describe it?
That might be a bit misleading.
Huh.
It is killing a lot of things. It's certainly not killing everything. So it's not the case that the soil is sterile afterwards. Our hope is that you've reduced the population of the microbes that you don't want, which are the pathogens, but not too severely reduce the population of the microbes that you do want. And there are a lot more microbes that you do want in your soil than ones you don't.
And some of the fields you studied are subjected to fumigation and non-fumigation treatments. What does fumigation do that then appeals to farmers, and how widely is it used?
Well, the big appeal is this pest control process. And in certain fields, that is very important. Without the fumigation, you see much reduced yields from the pathogens. It's used very extensively in Wisconsin, especially in that central area of the state, what we call the central sands. Our best numbers suggest around 80% of the potato acreage is fumigated every year. So that's about 65,000 acres of potatoes every year that are being subjected to this practice.
Are like organic crops, organic certified fields exposed to soil fumigation processes or these practices?
They would not be. No, none of the soil fumigant processes would be acceptable under an organic label.
What other crops are most often associated with chemical fumigation, soil fumigation?
So it's really used in what we call our high value crops. So something that is going to command a reasonable price. So these are largely vegetable crops and some fruits. In Wisconsin, it's mostly potatoes. There's sometimes fumigation used on other vegetable crops, like tomatoes in some cases, But potatoes is a big one in Wisconsin.
So what is the difference then between like soil fumigation and injecting these liquids right into the soil versus what happens in overhead crop dusting and applying chemicals to alter the soil that way?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one difference is that the soil fumigation process is, we call it broad spectrum, or it's not targeted, meaning that the chemicals that we use for fumigation are generally poisonous to a wide range of things. And it also needs to be done far in advance of growing your crop. So typical practice would be to fumigate in the fall, and then you grow your potato crop in that next following summer. So the farmers have to make a real long-term plan, whether they're going to do this or not, as opposed to managing, you know, a disease or an insect pest that you can see that's on the surface, on the leaves of your plant. Then you could wait, right, until you think the conditions are right for that disease. You could wait to see if you have it or not. You can be a lot more targeted in how you manage it. And because you might know what disease you're working with, because you can see it, you can also use a much more targeted chemistry to hit just that one kind of fungus or bacteria.
Oh, that makes sense. We're talking about soil fumigation, how it works, and the latest research in Wisconsin with UW-Madison plant pathologist Richard Lankow. Call in with questions and comments about farm fields and fumigation. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Richard, digging in a bit into your research, you found potatoes responding differently to fumigation depending where they're grown in our state. Is the difference related to varying soil types?
We think so. We think the biggest difference is what's already in that soil, both the chemistry of the soil, we call the structure of the soil, whether it's got a lot of organic matter in it, whether it's kind of a thicker, heavier soil with a lot of clay versus the really loose, very sandy soils that we have in the center of the state. All of those things affect how the chemistry of the fumigation works, but they also affect the whole soil ecosystem and all the other microbes. So one of the big take-home messages from our research was that soils that already have, if you call it healthier, microbial community, have a lot more of those beneficial microbes in them, don't need the fumigation as much. They can control the pathogen better on their own.
And I wonder, you know, with loamy soil or like rich soil that contains a mix of sand and silt and it's got the clay in it, how does a soil like that take to fumigation?
Yeah, so the heavier the soil with more of the clay and loam, the fumigant will move more slowly through that soil, just the gaseous form of the fumigant. And so there also might be more, you know, pockets in that soil where the fumigant can't get to. So in some ways it becomes less effective. Where in that loose sandy soil, a lot of air spaces, so the gaseous chemical can fill out the air spaces very effectively. And so it has a bigger impact on the soil microbes, both the good guys and the bad guys.
Both the good guys and the bad guys. So looking at that microbial life in a particular soil, can you talk about the yield responses to fumigation and the interplay there that you found in your research?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the interesting and important things we found was that in some cases, fumigation was doing exactly what it was supposed to, in that we were getting big positive responses in yield, much more yield in the fumigated part of the field versus the control unfumigated part. But that wasn't always the case. There were situations where the fumigation didn't increase yield, even a few cases where it decreased yield. And so part of our goal now is trying to understand why that is. Can we predict when this practice is going to be really necessary and when it could be skipped with no loss, and even situations where it would be detrimental?
I wonder if that's possible to take a soil sample in the early fall and be able to test it in some way to predict whether soil fumigation would be necessary.
Yeah, that is an excellent idea. And it is one we are actively trying to develop right now in our lab. One thing that has changed in our ability to to do something like that in the last few decades has been our increased ability to measure and understand the microbial component of soil. So farmers have for a very long time been able to test the chemistry of the soil and the structure of the soil. But being able to test, you know, what kind of microbes are in a given soil is not been available until relatively recently. But we have a lot more ability to do that now. So our hope is that we will be able to develop these recommendations that if you can test to the microbial component of your soil, we could fairly accurately predict whether you're going to have problems with a certain disease and how well that soil would respond to being fumigated.
But that also requires some flexibility on behalf of farmers who may do a consistent thing, you know, at a consistent time to their soil. It's been called the fumigation treadmill. You know, how does repeated fumigation affect soil?
That's a great question. It's actually not very well documented. We have this sense that repeated fumigation, while it may drive the pathogen populations down, it's also potentially driving down a lot of the other beneficial microbial populations and leaving soils in this more vulnerable state, where if the pathogen were to be reintroduced, there would be nothing to stop it from growing. And so the soil actually becomes more and more dependent on fumigation.
Richard Lankow is an associate professor of plant pathology at UW-Madison and an author of a study published in the journal Field Crops Research about soil fumigation and the effects on soil health in potato fields in particular. Call in with a question. You can add your views at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A UW-Madison study examines the soil management practice of soil fumigation, which is supposed to suppress weeds and improve crop yields. The researchers made discoveries, as we're talking about bacterial diversity in soil and yield responses in potato fields. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Richard Lankow is a UW-Madison Associate Professor of Plant Pathology. So, Richard, let's step back to talk about the people who apply fumigants, that they must complete Environmental Protection Agency training. They have to be certified. Who is doing this work?
It's mostly done by, you know, specialist consultants. So these would be groups of people, like you said, who have that training, also all that specialized equipment, and they would be contracted to come fumigate certain fields. It's not, unlike some other management practices, it's not usually done by the farmer himself.
And so these practices, you know, we've been talking about the microbial life and the impact there, but, you know, a soil has a pH. What is the impact of soil fumigation when, you know, this, or can the soil's natural acidity be altered?
So all sorts of aspects of the soil properties, if you will, we found can be altered. And it's a little unclear what's driving what. Because soil is such an integrated system, if you change one thing, you can end up changing lots of other things downstream. So we've seen changes in soil nutrient profiles, right? The specific chemistry of certain elements, pH, all sorts of other things. And I guess the important thing to think and keep in mind is that those all work together, right? It's really difficult to pull out any one particular consequence of the practice.
Well, let's pull out one particular chemical. Your study focused on the soil fumigant metam sodium. Most widely used of agricultural pesticides, one of them. What are the health and safety concerns of metam sodium?
Yeah, it does have some serious health concerns for the people applying it. and anyone in the nearby area. So because it, as we said, it turns into a gas and then evaporates out of the soil, it has the potential to be inhaled, and it can be a serious skin and respiratory irritant. So anyone applying the fumigant needs to be very careful and have all the proper protective equipment. And it needs to be done carefully, you know, at the right place and time to avoid any drift of the volatile chemical into people living off the farm. And that has happened in the past in some cases. So it's something that applicators are just very aware of.
What kind of PPE? Is it like full suits or just respirators?
Respirators, depending on which fumigant chemical is used, some variety of respirator could be a half, sort of a half face, or could be a full, you know, enclose your whole head kind of apparatus.
What could happen to skin? I mean, I would imagine it would be a huge skin irritant.
Yeah. I mean, I've not personally experienced it, so I won't describe what it feels like, but I understand it, you know, can cause, yeah, irritation, itching, and retching, rash type things if you're exposed to a high quantity of it.
Mark and Sun Prairie called in and said that they grew up in northern Wisconsin. It's part of the state where people grow lots of potatoes, Mark said, and notices that there's also a lot of cancer in the area. And is just wondering how dangerous in general are the chemicals for people's health in soil fumigation?
I'm not aware of any links between the specific chemicals used in fumigation and sort of long-term chronic health problems in people. So part of the, you know, the concern with fumigation is the fact that they do volatilize and get up into the air, but that also means that they dissipate fairly quickly. So they're different from some of the other agricultural inputs that have a long-term persistence in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as I'm aware, and I should caveat that I'm absolutely not an expert on the human health or public health aspects of this. The concern with these chemicals is more short-term.
There's another fumigant used to control pests. It's methyl bromide, and the EPA says methyl bromide contributes to ozone layer depletion. Mm-hmm. So production and use of the gas has been phased out in the United States. Has restricted use of methyl bromide resulted in a greater reliance on other fumigants?
In some industries, that's true. Methyl bromide was, again, used in specific industries to tackle specific problems where it's been largely phased out. It's not entirely phased out yet. There are still some industries that use it in targeted ways. In some cases, they've switched to other fumigants like chlorpicrin or dimethyl sodium. In other cases, they've found other solutions to the problem.
Richard Lankow is with us as we talk about agricultural soil health and fumigation practices, especially in Wisconsin potato fields. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Richard, what alternatives to chemical fumigation exist on the landscape?
Yeah, we're exploring a number of options. One idea is to use plants themselves, what we call cover crops, which are plants you grow in a field in between the cash crop you're growing to sell. And so you're growing them not to make money off them, but to do something beneficial for your soil. So some potential cover crops may be able to help suppress some of these pathogens in the same way that the fumigant does. We're also just generally interested in how we can make soils healthier so that the pathogen problem is not as much of a problem. So fumigation is less necessary if we have healthier microbial communities in their soil that make it harder for the pathogen to invade.
And cover crops, you know, they're supposed to help keep that topsoil in place. Is fumigation linked to any causes in any sort of erosion, or does the practice deplete topsoil?
Yeah, interesting you ask that. Not directly the chemical is it so much, but remember, this is the chemical that has to be injected deep into the soil.
Yes.
So in order to do that, you have to rip up the soil. right? You have to till it deeply in order to get these shanks that inject the chemical in deep. And so that physical disruption of the soil can lead to erosion, can contribute to a loss of soil health in other ways.
Where will your research go from here? It seems like there are still quite a bit of unknowns.
There absolutely are. And so where our major focus right now is trying to understand that microbial community in the soil, the non-pathogenic microbes, how they're responding to the fumigants, but also how they can recover from fumigation, how they can recover from a long-term history of fumigation, as you mentioned. And with the ultimate goal of trying to figure out, are there ways, things we can do, practices that growers can take that would improve the health of their soil, promote the diversity of beneficial microbes, and get that soil to a place where the fumigation isn't needed, or isn't needed as much, relying more on the sort of native ability of the soil ecosystem to control soil-borne pathogens rather than relying on chemical inputs. And that's a movement that's been very much supported by the growers in the state. They are dedicated to finding more sustainable practices and trying to reduce this fumigation practice in particular, both because of human health concerns, environmental concerns, and just economic concerns.
Richard, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Richard Lenkow is an associate professor of plant pathology and principal investigator of a lab studying soil health in UW-Madison's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.